You've been listening to Women's Magazine. This is KPFA 94.1. My name is Val Ibera. I'm here with a representative from La Casa de las Madres, Lindsay Sweetnam, the Community Programs Director at La Casa de las Madres. Welcome to Women's Magazine. So La Casa de las Madres is a local San Francisco organization that helps women and children who are victims of or experience domestic violence. Can you give us a little background about La Casa de las Madres and the services that it provides?
La Casa started back in 1976. There was a group of women who had all experienced violence in their lives, either growing up in their families or as they developed relationships of their own as they became adults. And unfortunately, one of these women lost her mother to domestic violence. Her mother was murdered by her stepfather. And that and the other shared experiences between the women really prompted the conversation of there needs to be somewhere, a safe place for people to escape domestic violence. And there really wasn't at that time. So based on those conversations, they started a shelter. It was the first domestic violence shelter in the state of California and actually the second one in the country. It is still the largest shelter in the city of San Francisco. Our shelter houses up to 35 women and children every night. And over the last 36 years now, we've developed a variety of other services as well. So we provide case management for two supportive housing buildings that serve formerly homeless women. They're women-only buildings, which is actually unique to San Francisco. They're the only single-gender supportive housing that exists here in the city. So that is an environment that has created a lot of safety for the women there. And then we have our community programs based out of our drop-in center, sort of the hub of our services. So we have individual counseling, support groups. We provide legal assistance for restraining orders. We have a teen program. We do community education and outreach, which entails sort of workshops and presentations to a variety of populations, service providers, students in schools, people in housing sites, sort of really anywhere you can imagine. And then we also have two advocates at the police department at 850 Bryant who respond to the domestic violence reports that come in, and we have two 24-hour crisis lines that we also run, an adult line and a teen line, and those are both 24 hours a day. We answer those phones all 24 hours of the day, so it's never going to be an answer machine, it's never going to be a call back, so those are really great to have as well. So the adult line is 877-503-1850.
And it's interesting that you have an adult line and you have a teen line.
February is Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, so we do lots and lots of activities to celebrate that month. Well, obviously, we're doing the direct intervention services, the individual counseling and the support groups that we're doing all year round. And then we're doing workshops, you know, kind of domestic violence 101 in schools and community-based organizations and really anywhere that people have the need. And then one of the unique things that we do in February is a bracelet campaign. It's called Girls Got Each Other's Backs. So it's a purple beaded bracelet, and it has a card attached to it that says Girls Got Each Other's Backs. And it just talks about the idea that if you need someone to talk to, you don't know where to turn, you give the bracelet to a friend to let her know that you're there to support her. And then it also has resources like our teen line, which is 877-923-0700, and a variety of other resources in San Francisco as well. So we go around and do tabling events at as many high schools as possible, other community organizations that are having events. I know we gave out a whole bunch at 1 Billion Rising on Valentine's Day, which was really exciting. We were able to go to Stonestown Mall one day and pass them out. So lots of really exciting events for Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month last month.
On that same note, what are some of the unique needs that La Casa understands about the needs for teens to know versus the women who actually come to the shelters as their adults?
There's certainly a lot of overlap in terms of the dynamics of domestic violence. You know, we know that domestic violence at its root is about power and control. So those are the kinds of things that don't necessarily change based on the age, but there are a lot of unique needs of teens. One of the unique needs of teens is that they're just starting off in relationships. So for many of them, this might be their first relationship. So they're just sort of learning who they are and who they are in a relationship. And if we can sort of teach them as they're entering or provide that support while they're in that relationship, the idea is to really break the cycle before it continues into adulthood and things like that. I think there's really an increased across all ages, but especially teens, digital abuse is something that teens may be experiencing in really high rates. So teaching people about privacy and their rights and their boundaries, you know, you don't have to give your partner your password to Facebook or Twitter. You know, it's not normal for somebody to text you 75 times in 20 minutes. Sort of those things that become part of our everyday life now that need to really be included, because that's part of abuse that teens are experiencing as well.
I think that's really an important point with the digital abuse, because I was thinking the other day, I finally got a landline when I was about 12. And, you know, I talked to maybe like six of my friends. But iPhones and access to the internet is really, there's really a limit placed on what people can see at any age, and if they're young, what their parents are aware of them seeing.
You know, it's such a different world than it was 10 years ago. I mean, I think I share that similarity with you, that when I was growing up, it was like, if you could get your own landline, that was a big deal. That was the cool thing. You know, hit the dial-up AOL in sort of a central location in the house.
Right.
So there wasn't the same connectivity. There wasn't the same access. There wasn't the same privacy. Whereas now, you know, everybody has a cell phone for safety, and there's really great reasons to have that, but it also opens up a lot of doors. So it just adds to the need for safety planning and taking that into consideration when creating safety and talking to teens about what's okay and what's not okay.
Well, let's kind of jump to the other end of the spectrum, because I know La Casa recently started a new program called Ending Abuse Later in Life, and that's for women over 50. Can you tell us about that program and what was the impetus for creating that program?
This program, like any programs, really created out of a need that we saw that wasn't being met sufficiently. So program is for 50 and up, but really I want to talk just a little bit about the age group of 50 to 65, because that's really one of the sort of invisible groups really in the victims of domestic violence. One of the things to know about this group is that it is, of course, growing very, very rapidly. And it's sort of this middle ground almost. You know, these are people who are experiencing domestic violence in the same rates, at least, as every other age group, and yet are disproportionately not accessing services. So I think that's for a lot of reasons. People feeling like services really weren't for them. They were for either targeted towards younger people or older people. You know, they were for elders, which that population doesn't, you know, resonate with, but also maybe more geared towards families. So this group also really has a lack of resources in a lot of ways, because they're not yet qualifying for Social Security. They're not yet qualifying for housing for elderly. And at the same time, it's more likely that their children, if they had children, their dependents are grown and moving out of the house. So they also don't qualify for family services. So there's really this gap. And that's really what we look to address, that this is something that's happening to everyone, and there are services for everyone, and there are services specifically for this 50 to 65 age group, that we don't want them to fall through the cracks and to feel like there aren't services for them. So we think it's really important just to talk about it is for you. You know, we have this space that understands sort of the unique position that you're in as well.
And what are some of those specific services that are geared towards that age group?
You know, it's individual counseling. It's a support group, specifically ending abuse later in life support group. So, you know, the staff that's participating in those really have the knowledge and the training and understanding of this unique population. One of the other things is really expanding our knowledge citywide. One of the things that we were privileged enough to be able to do starting a few years ago in collaboration with a lot of partners, the Mayor's Office on Housing, the Police Department, the District Attorney's Office, Adult Protective Services, and the Institute on Aging, was to create a training about abuse later in life that we were able to reach 527 San Francisco police officers in that training to really address the unique needs of victims ages 50 and up, the unique barriers, the unique types of abuse and things like that. So that's something that we're very, very proud of as well. In addition to the direct services, making sure that other people who are providing direct services have that same knowledge and that same understanding.
That's really excellent. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about how La Casa interacts with and works with some of the other city departments that you just mentioned?
Well, starting with the police department, we've had a partnership with them for a very long time, and we actually have two advocates, our domestic violence response team advocates, who have their office in the police department at 850 Bryant. They're part of, you know, they have their office just outside of the special victims unit. And so what happens is they receive the reports of domestic violence and follow up with victims to see what sort of services they may need. And we've found sort of on average about 70% of victims that we reach out to through that collaboration do accept some type of service, whether that's just sort of the initial crisis counseling session with an advocate, whether it's pursuing a restraining order, whether it's coming into shelter, whether it's resources and referrals, sort of whatever the needs are. But that's pretty tremendous. And I think that's a population that oftentimes maybe we wouldn't see otherwise, and other domestic violence agencies in the city wouldn't see otherwise. So really uniquely being located in the police department, I think, provides tremendous value to victims who maybe don't know about other services, but because we're there, they're able to get connected and get the support that they need.
That's fantastic, because I think, I mean, just like we were talking about with the teens and in any situation, being educated and just having the knowledge that something is there and that there are other possibilities can really change somebody's perspective. So when women come in and when women go into your shelter, how long are they staying there? How are they getting through these problems? What are some of the different situations that play out after they start to receive services?
So our shelter program is up to 8 weeks. People certainly that stay for the entire 8 weeks. We have people that might stay for a few nights. So somebody's experience can look a variety of different ways. But once somebody's there, they have a case manager that they're working with to just sort of address what their highest needs are. Housing is certainly one of the most common high needs for the families coming into our shelter, as well as certainly, you know, there could be substance abuse issues or mental health or getting connected to CalWORKs and CalFresh, schools, education. I mean, there's sort of an endless number of possibilities. So the case manager is really there to partner with the clients and help them determine sort of what their highest needs are.
The state of affairs in San Francisco so far as housing is a real housing crunch right now. Has that been posing a bigger burden on some of the counselors, the housing counselors, and the families that come in?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we all know that San Francisco is a fantastic city, and part of it being a fantastic city is that a lot of people really want to be here. So housing is very expensive. It is very limited. So it poses a really big challenge for our clients and in turn, certainly our staff. You know, we're always working to find appropriate housing opportunities that are affordable, that are safe, that are geographically desirable for, you know, what the person's trying to do with their life. So it's definitely a challenge that we face and that I think all agencies face. You know, wait lists can be very, very long, can be very difficult to afford housing. So trying to get our clients out of homelessness or prevent them from going into homelessness is a huge part of what we're working on.
And let's talk about homelessness, because I was speaking with Rose Aguilar. She's the host of KALW, and she did a long investigative piece that she wrote an article for The Nation called Old Female Homeless in San Francisco. And one of the things that she noted, one of the women whose trust that she had gained had said that of the women that this homeless woman had met on the street, she said pretty much any homeless woman is almost guaranteed to experience some sort of assault, whether or not that's just a random assault or if they hook up with a man to have some sort of safety, he can often turn on her. What are some of the unique situations that come up with homeless women who come in for services to La Casa?
The sort of fields of homelessness and domestic violence are undeniably incredibly interrelated. We know that domestic violence is one of the leading causes of homelessness for women and children, if not the leading cause. I've seen it cited as the leading cause and maybe the number two cause in some other sources. So regardless, it's a huge problem. On the other side, being homeless puts you at increased risk for experiencing domestic violence as well. But going back to domestic violence being one of the leading causes of homelessness for women and children, it's a real problem. You know, there's a reality that abused people face. Do I want to stay in my stable home? or do I want to leave this abusive relationship? And I'm not quite sure what the next step is going to be. You know, we've sort of touched on this lack of affordable housing, long waiting lists. And so it does at times, you know, force people to choose between staying in a home or being homeless. And then there's a lot of other sort of unique needs of victims of domestic violence that can prevent them from getting into housing. You know, they may have poor credit records if financial abuse has been part of their experience, or just no credit if their partner sort of had everything in his name or her name. Maybe spotty employment histories, depending on if they were permitted to work or if they had to quit jobs, or, you know, sometimes partners come into jobs and you lose your job, which is going to reflect negatively in your employment history. You know, rental history, maybe there was noise complaints at the unit, damage to the unit, things like that, or you have no rental history again because it was in the partner's name. So there's, I mean, almost an endless number of ways that victims of domestic violence face sort of unique needs in accessing housing, in maintaining housing, in preventing eviction. You know, some landlords may discriminate against victims if they have a restraining order because they think, oh, you know, I don't want that on my property. There are some laws now supporting victims of domestic violence saying you can't discriminate against a victim of domestic violence, but they're not across the board, and they're, of course, not always enforced to the highest level. So that's definitely something we advocate for as well.
Well, you bring up some really hard-hitting points that domestic violence, we think of it as a cycle of violence sometimes, and all of those other points are things that maybe other people don't see. Maybe the family doesn't know about, maybe, you know, the broader family, the extended family, maybe people's friends don't really know about. What would LaCosta say to the greater community, people who may not be experiencing these situations, but see it around them, or what should people be aware of?
I mean, one of the messages that I think is really important for everybody to understand, that I think is one of the most common misconceptions or sort of common things that people don't understand, is somebody who's staying in an abusive relationship has reasons why they're staying in that relationship. So I think well-meaning family members and friends and other support people say, you know, leave that relationship. You have to leave. You have to leave. And that's coming from a caring place where they want the person to be safe, but what they're not understanding is there's reasons why the person is staying. They can't support themselves economically, or they're afraid. They're afraid because this person has said, if you leave me, I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to hurt the kids. I'm going to make your life harder. Those kinds of things. That they love the partner, that it's generally not bad 100% of the time. You know, we know the cycle of violence sort of with the tension building phase and the explosion phase. And then there's that honeymoon phase where they do see the person that they fell in love with, the person that perhaps is, you know, the mother or father of their children. So there's a lot of things that keep victims in relationships, and it's really important to just acknowledge that those are valid and they play into why someone might not leave. And when we can start to address some of those things, then sometimes maybe people can feel safe to take that next step if that's what's going to be right for them.
It kind of leads into, I was reading an article in the San Francisco Public Press, and it was referencing the records of prosecutors from around the Bay Area who reviewed, you know, 92,000 cases. And one of the things that the article mentioned is that half of all murders of women are the result of domestic violence. And also the fact that domestic violence, a violent assault, often, basically the nature of domestic violence is, like you said, kind of an escalating problem. You know, it can kind of simmer, and then there could be an explosion. But sometimes the police will go to the household for some sort of complaint, you know, four or five, several times before there's actually a violent assault. For women who might be experiencing some sort of domestic issues where the police have been called, but there hasn't been a violent interaction yet, what is some advice that LaCosta would give?
One of the first things I'd like to say is that we certainly acknowledge and we work towards supporting everyone in acknowledging that domestic violence is a lot more than physical violence. Obviously, that's a very serious, very big part of it, but it's also emotional abuse, psychological abuse, financial abuse, sexual abuse, isolating your partner, intimidation. There's so many other dynamics. So that's one of the first things that I think is really important, is recognizing the seriousness of all those different types. And beyond that, I mean, I think the most important messages that anybody can hear is it's not your fault, and there's help. There's help out there. You do not have to be ready to leave your relationship. You can still call and talk to someone. I mean, when we talk about our hotline to people, that's what we tell people. You know, this crisis line is if you need shelter, it's if you just need to talk to someone, it's if you're not sure what you need, it's if you need resources and referrals. We're here to talk to you if you're in the process of leaving your relationship. We're here to talk to you if you know there's no way you're going to leave your relationship, but you still need a little support. And we can talk about ways that you can increase your safety even in that context. So, I mean, that's one of the most important messages, is that there's help out there. There's people who are available to talk to you no matter where you are in that cycle, no matter where you are in that decision-making, that you don't need to be ready to leave to reach out and talk to someone.
And again, I'm talking to Lindsay Sweetnam. She's the Community Programs Director at La Casa de las Madres in San Francisco. Could you give those numbers again, please?
Absolutely. Our 24-hour adult crisis line is 877-503-1850. And the teen crisis line, that is also 24 hours a day, is 877-923-0700. And if you just have, you know, regular questions about our services or want to set up an appointment, we also have a business line Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 5. That's 415-503-0500.
Great. We love to get that information out there. I kind of want to shift a little bit. So you were talking about some of the laws that are in place that help people in these situations. And I wanted to talk about the Violence Against Women Act. So Congress recently reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act, which was enacted originally in 1994 and was reauthorized. It's now been reauthorized three times. This particular past year, there was a delay in reauthorizing it because the House had wanted to kind of strip it down to eliminate protections for gay and transgender people and also Native American women. But actually, with great success, the Senate's full version, which included those populations, recently passed. So the Violence Against Women's Act, President Obama signed it. So how does that legislation play a role in the prevention and intervention of domestic violence? And also, how does it affect organizations like La Casa who are working with in this field?
The effects of VAWA are many on many different levels. I mean, as you sort of touched on a little bit, some of the largest aspects, the sort of key provisions of the Senate version that luckily passed very recently and again was signed into law, do involve closing the loophole on crimes being prosecuted against Native American victims, that the tribal courts now have the authority to prosecute for crimes that happen on their land, which is really, really important. For the first time, LGBT survivors are explicitly acknowledged and recognized and included as part of the law. And you know, the further protections for immigrants, you know, making sure that U visas are still available and closing some of the other sort of loopholes that were making it more difficult for those populations to get services. So those are huge in so many different ways. You know, it's making sure we're including all populations that are being affected. It's looking at, you know, some of those populations have been included previously, but we see what wasn't quite working right yet and improve upon those things. So it's a very powerful message that we care. We care about you. The United States government is looking at this and addressing that there are needs that are not being met and working to fix those. So it's an important message to all victims that we're going to talk about violence against women. We're going to make laws. We're going to uphold those laws. So that's, I think, sort of the bigger scale that, you know, it sends a message that it's being talked about, that people care, that it's not okay, and that we're going to hold people accountable for doing those things. And that affects our work on so many levels.
What are some of the ways it affects your work?
Being able to tell victims about those things. I mean, being able to tell victims who may be here and not have a legal status but have suffered severe violence, you know, if you are willing to make a report and, you know, work with the police, that there is opportunity for you to improve your safety. That's really important, and that's something that we're proud that a lot of our victims have been able to get connected with if that fits one of their needs. You know, just in general, La Casa doesn't directly receive VAWA funds, and yet there's still a tremendous effect on that law in our ability to provide services. first of all, many agencies do, but those funds also go to sort of a larger pool in California that funds over 100 shelter-based programs throughout the state. So, you know, any sort of funding could potentially affect so many thousands of victims all over the state. So it's so essential, and we're so happy to see that it's passed and been signed.
So if somebody were listening to this and they're not in San Francisco, what would you recommend? I mean, could they still call a CASA and get a referral to some place in their area?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, depending on sort of where they are, we may have the capacity to help them directly. And if we don't, you know, we would refer them to the national hotline that could provide them with services in their area wherever they are. So we're certainly, we work in, you know, fairly close collaboration with shelters in the city and in sort of the immediately surrounding counties, Marin, San Mateo, Alameda, Contra Costa. And if, you know, somebody's calling from another location, then we would refer them to the national hotline to make sure that they're able to get services in their area.
The National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. 1-800-799-SAFE. And so how does La Casa gauge its success? What are some of the relationships that are established between your organization and some of the women who access the services?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. Success can look so many different ways, and there's definitely not one definition of success. And I think it's really driven by the people that we work with. What is success going to look like for them? So for some people, making that first phone call is success. They never thought they could do it, or they never knew that there were services. And just the fact that they were able to reach out and talk to someone and sort of acknowledge what's going on, that's success. For other people, success may be following through and getting a restraining order and feeling like they've got something that can really empower them and enhance their safety, and they've got something tangible that they can really use to support themselves. For other people, success is getting out of the relationship and, you know, maybe going to shelter and eventually creating stable housing of their own and having a stable life and being able to move forward and heal themselves and, you know, eventually either be on their own or enter into a healthy relationship someday and sort of learn what that would look like. For other people, success can be going to a support group every week and staying connected. One of the things that we know is that abusive people, one of their main tactics is to isolate their victims, because the more someone's isolated, the less likely they are to be able to get help. So for so many people, being able to be a part of a support group is really getting that sense of community back that maybe they lost during the abuse, and seeing there's people just like me. Of course, everyone's individual stories are different, but so many of the dynamics are the same. And so it's so powerful for people to be able to see there's people that went through the same things that I went through or felt the same things that I felt, even if their experiences were different. So again, I think success looks a lot of different ways, and it's really dependent on each individual person and what their needs are and what their goals are.
And one of the programs that you wanted to talk about today was the Economic Empowerment series that you're doing. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. You know, I was so excited this morning when I read President Obama's statement for International Women's Day, but he actually mentioned, he said, as a nation, we've launched new efforts to promote women's economic empowerment and political participation to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. So I thought it was pretty cool that he acknowledged that. We have been doing an economic empowerment series with our clients since fall of 2010 was the first one. So we've done that in a few different ways. You know, the initial partnership was with Bank on San Francisco and the San Francisco DA's office. We recently just finished our second of two series through a Latino Community Foundation grant and are gearing up to start working through a grant from the Office of Violence Against Women, again, in partnership with many others in San Francisco. So these workshops, just to sort of sum them up, are, it's a series, it's three workshops with a financial coach who talks to the participants about just the basics, budgeting, managing your debt. What is a credit report? How do you pull a credit report? How do you fix your credit report? What is credit? What are the resources and supports? So what we've found is so many people, almost every, you know, victim of domestic violence, it affects their financial viability, if you will, in some way or another. That could be because they weren't allowed to work, or because their partner managed their finances, or they just never got the education about how to be in charge of the finances. So it's amazing to see what it can do for someone to learn these things and sort of have that demystified and understand why it's important to have a bank account and how to get a bank account, even if you have a bad credit history. Bank on SF has lots of options for people who wouldn't be able to get bank accounts otherwise. So just getting connected to that knowledge and those resources to really reestablish yourself is so empowering for someone and really allows people to be able to move forward in ways that sometimes they're not able to otherwise if they don't have the skills or if they have a bad credit report or something holding them back.
And how can people get access to these programs?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked. We, again, are gearing up for 8 series of workshops over the next 2 years. We'll be doing one per quarter, probably alternating in English and Spanish. So if people are really interested in that, you know, give our drop-in center a call and see how you can participate. That number is 415-503-0500. You know, we definitely want to be able to support as many people as we can.
That's so cool. And I think it's wonderful that it's in English and in Spanish. But also, from what I understand, if people call the hotline, there may be some volunteers or interpreters available to speak in different languages as well.
Absolutely. So we, 24 hours a day, have English and Spanish capacity sort of on site. You know, our staff is largely bilingual. So there's always going to be English and Spanish, you know, sort of live person there. But if there's other languages, and there frequently are other languages, we are able to access Language Line, you know, immediately that moment and have an interpreter on the line to be able to address the immediate needs, depending on sort of the urgency of the situation. If there are times where perhaps there's, you know, an appointment needs to be made, but there's a little less of a crisis situation, we also have staff who speak other languages, volunteers who speak like 18 at least other languages, I think. So, you know, we definitely are going to be able to speak with anyone regardless of their language.
Which is incredible. And I hope that other places around the country and around the state are able to acknowledge the need for, you know, multiple languages to be spoken. And the fact that the Violence Against Women Act that just passed does acknowledge the immigrants who may be experiencing these problems in their lives and might be able to get a temporary visa to hold them over and get them into a safer environment. So do you have any final things you'd like to mention?
Just to sort of reiterate, you know, I know we were talking about homelessness a little bit. I think it's so important to understand how being a victim of domestic violence or being labeled as such can just affect every aspect of the housing process. So just understanding, you know, in the application process, maybe the rental history is in the batterer's name, or there's the history of, you know, damage to the unit. Oftentimes I've had people tell me, you know, I can't use my current landlord as a reference because I'm still living with my abusive partner and I'm afraid that he or she's going to find out that I'm trying to leave. You know, a survivor may have a criminal history based on self-defense, but it still looks like a criminal history that, you know, a landlord may not allow into their building. Again, you know, credit, the financial abuse piece is so huge. Oftentimes victims are dealing with, if they're not living with their partner anymore, maybe someone who's stalking them or threatening them, coming onto the property. So sometimes survivors are afraid if they call the police, the property manager might not want the police on their property, or that's going to negatively affect them. So they're afraid. A survivor sometimes needs to break a lease to leave very quickly for safety, may need to change locks. There's just so many different aspects that affect victims or survivors of domestic violence in the housing process that contributes to the homelessness that I think people don't often realize how many different ways it's really affecting people. And so by beginning to address those, and again, there are laws that have started to address some of those, you know, allowing people to break a lease if they need to leave for domestic violence. You know, there's time limits now in California and how quickly a lock needs to be changed, things like that. And there's always room for improvement. There's always room for more laws and more protections so that victims of domestic violence are not discriminated against in housing, in employment, in any of the other barriers they face to be able to move forward in their lives. You know, for those people who have left the relationship and are working so hard to create a new life for themselves and for their family, if they have a family as well, let's not make that harder for people. Let's support it in any way that we can.
I really, really appreciate you coming in today, Lindsay Sweeten. I'm the Community Programs Director from La Casa de las Madres. And the motto from La Casa is a refuge, an advocate, and a strong voice against domestic violence. Thank you for listening to Women's Magazine. My name is Val Ibarra from Mutiny Radio. You are listening to KPFA 94.1.